said I had what we were doing, who was doing what, and what, how our effort was.
Do you have that here?
I don't have it here, but I can locate it.
Yeah, it'd be good if we could get that all into the file.
But this was some really early opinions on where PPO was going to be. But,
so you really had to go out and get funding because of polycarbonate precluding any effort being made.
There were very few people around who were interested in supporting another thermoplastic molding compound, with one exception. The exception was Charlie Reed, who was at this point in metallurgy course. But Charlie said, what would Dow or DuPont do if they had something like this? They would put an army on it. He said, what's wrong with you guys? He said, if you won't pay your share, he said, you can double or triple my assessment. Because I think this is a thing that needs support. This is the kind of chemistry we ought to do. So he literally was a man who sang for our supper and kept it going with the other narrow-minded individuals who were running our other departments who were more interested in how quick can we get a payback on the plant that we already have before we do anything else new.
Did you ever try and convince Al Hay that he should come over here and get into development?
Yes, I
get into the trenches.
I talked with him once, but at the time he was working for Jack Elliott at one time, and Jack Elliott was about to leave, and he, I think, had that position in mind rather than coming over here. The other one was, at one time, he was all set to go to our, which was our insulation materials department, because they were going to go in a big way into polyesters, and Al had just invented a route to oxidation of xylene to terephthalic and isophthalic acid, and they had proffered a job and was telling them what a great opportunity it was and all sorts of things, and then the plant burned down. Had a little explosion that burned down, so we went out of that business. But, I talked with Al a couple times. But he had a home where he was. He had everything he wanted. But an interesting thing, one of the other interesting things, was my job here was censoring any research lab publications that was relevant as far as plastics was concerned. And he had invented this stuff in 56, I think, and I had sat on quite a few attempts to publish. But he slipped one by in the Journal of Physics Review, or Physics, something or other, which I didn't bother finding or didn't check, and that one got published. And that was the first disclosure that got out on his work. But no story on that later. But that was the basis or the thing that got us into Europe, was my missing his publication on PPO. But we kept the thing going here. And incidentally, the top man at this time was Ruben Butoff. And he proceeded to set up a new organization. I'm just a little bit ahead of myself. Ruben was in charge, but I was still doing the advanced development, and another man by the name of Copeland was doing the engineering, and the marketing, he had hired a man by the name of PhD from Louisville. He's dead now.
That's
Pinholt. Paul Pinholt. And Pinholt was a dreamer, and we owe a lot to him. He was another one of those people that would sell things that he didn't have and then go back and tell the troops that you have to deliver, you're committed. And he really had a vivid imagination, way beyond the realm of reality many times. But it was the type of thing we needed. One of the wild things that he did, among other things, was to, somewhere around this time, we had, we're all aware that, I'll go back to it. In order to keep our money coming, we had to have show and tells for our department managers who supported us. And one of the things I needed was some PPO parts. And we couldn't mold parts for the dam. I remember that Edie Boldebuck had mixed some low molecular weight polystyrene with PPO and used it for another application. And so I mixed some with our PPO and found out that it made a nice transparent polymer. And if you put enough polystyrene in, you could process it. Except the parts were extremely brittle. And so we used to mold the PPO styrene parts and show them to our audience for show and tell, but never let them get out of your hands, or else they twist them and break. One time Al Gilbert did get one and broke it. It was kind of embarrassing. He was there as a guest listening to our song and dance. But anyhow, we knew that the PPO was compatible. And Pinholt sold the exclusive rights to Rexel Chemical, or Rexel Dart, to try to find some useful applications of combinations of styrene and polystyrene and PPO, and he gave them a year exclusive for $50,000 or $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they screwed around for a year and didn't accomplish anything, and their right lapsed when we got it back. But
that's a good story, isn't it?
The other one he was going on was Warren Paper Company. He wanted to see whether they would pay $50,000 or $60,000 for the right to see whether there's any paper connected application to PPO. And that one didn't go through, but this was trying to raise money to keep this damn project going.
You couldn't get any support from Beakey and
Beakey and company derive all their support from the same people that we're getting our support from.
Mm-hmm.
We pay dues or tariffs,
yeah,
or taxes, yeah, to the research lab.
Yeah.
And so the people that, yeah, we were trying to get money from were paying to support us and also paying to support Beakey and Company.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't any possibility, yeah, there. So we really did some scrounging. And I think it took the guys with guts, if you will, like Pinholt, to scrape up money to keep this thing going.
Was Welsh in the picture at this
point?
Well,
he came in 1960, and I started and I ended up. We had this process to the point where we were making it in glass in probably a couple liter reactors. There were some of us a little bit concerned about pumping oxygen into hot toluene.
It's like a carburetor.
And we wanted to get to metal. And we wanted to scale up. And we didn't have any facility to go into, but I had a room out back which had been a high pressure laboratory. And we wanted to get that thing going, and we needed an engineer. And the Welsh came looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been invited in by the chemical materials people who ran the polycarbonate business. And he had not been invited by me. And they told me that I could talk with them after they were through. And they kept him till about 4:30. Roy Moody was one of the guys who stalled him and trying to sell him on coming to work in polycarbonates.
Mm-hmm.
And at 4:30 they gave him to me and told me that I could have him now to talk to, but remember he has to catch a 5:30 train back to Urbana. Mm-hmm. So I had the hour and asked him whether he'd mind missing the train and talked with him and liked him and gave him a real sales pitch, and he decided to come to work for us on PPO.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was the first engineer we had on the premises to work on PPO. Other guy that came in almost at the same time was a guy named Al Gowan. And Al Gowan, or Alistair Gowan, was from Edinburgh and went to a postdoc at British Columbia, polymer physical chemist. And I managed to get him. They both came in summer of 60, like right after graduation, 60. Gowan turned out to work his way up through till he ran the PPO business for a while, and then he ended up with our first, or our second guy in Europe, running Europe, and ended up being VP and general of GE in Europe for a while, and then eventually came back and ran the metallurgical business for a while, and then worked his way out of the company. Now he's with John Brown Equipment. But very sharp guy. The sidelines, he and Welsh were scratch golfers when they hit here. And they took on all the local people, thought they were good. But took them down a peg. But Welsh came, set up a little pilot plant. The first reactor was literally a modified copper kettle drum. There was an outfit in town that does metal spinning, and they made a copper kettle drum with flange on top, and they put a plate on top of it and some bushings, and that became our first PPO facility. And we ran into a real major stumbling block, and that was that we found out that if we took all the PPO, or all the dimethylphenol in the world, could get it, and it was scattered as about 1 or 2% content in the coal tar, we wouldn't have enough to run a plant.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to have a PPO process, and Gutoff did a good job, I think, of pushing on the research laboratory to develop a PPO monomer process.
That was another Hay project.
Steve Hamilton was the man who did that eventually. But he was pushing on Hay and Elliott to get Elliott was the boss still to get the thing going. But we started a project of our own, and we went down to Princeton and hired Princeton Research Associates, which was a spin-off from an outfit called Petrotex when they went to Texas. Cal Wolf was a key guy.
Right, that's right.
We hired them to develop a process. So we had three processes going simultaneously. And a guy named Steve Hamilton pulled the plum out, found a particular catalyst in methanol, and phenol could be made into monomer, and that ended up, we piloted that here at Pittsfield, and we scaled up the little miniature plant that Welsh built till we were making some hundreds of pounds of polymer, and moved along pretty well. Finally it got set up as a separate business, with the manager of engineering being Jack Welsh, and the manager of marketing was Pinhole. I'm not sure. I think Gowan may have taken the technology, but somewhere around the line, Chenian got in, and Chenian ran the R&D function for the PPO for a while.
Mm-hmm. So you made the product announcement for PPO in about 1963.
I think so.
And you were aware at this time that it had these oxidation problems and high
voltage? Oh, definitely. But I called it PPO, polyphenylene oxide, not polyxylene oxide. If I had thought we were going to stay with dimethylphenol, I would have called it PXO. But I was sure as hell that somebody was going to be smart enough to figure out how to make my old PPO by oxidizing phenol. And a fair amount of effort went into trying to do that unsuccessfully. And for a while we tried to compromise and make para methyl or cresol, from orthocresol.
Yeah.
But we weren't able to make it. But I had my heart set on PPO, and that's what I wanted. And I'd say that I didn't do too much in the line of making a product out of it. Other than putting the styrene with it. And one of the persons, or one of the things that did a hell of a lot of, made a contribution, almost by accident, but a major contribution. We ran into some later controversy with him, with a man by the name of Eric Cizik. And Eric Cizik has the basic patent for impact modified PPO Noryl.
The rubber modified.
That's what cured that brittleness problem that you talked about earlier.
And I didn't know anything about impact modification, and nobody else around our whole system knew anything about it. And if anybody at the research lab knew about it, they sure wouldn't tell us about it. But everybody was aware that we could mold and fabricate the stuff, but it was brittle. And what we were doing is buying crystal styrene and mixing with it. And where Edie Bolderbuck came in, Edie Bolderbuck had much earlier tried to modify the milk viscosity of low molecular weight styrene by putting a little bit of PPO in. And she claimed that composition of matter and got a patent on it. So we have a composition of matter patent on PPO styrene, but it really isn't worth a damn for anything. And the only one that's worth anything is the impact modified material.
Mm-hmm. How was it impact modified?
It was impact modified. In the first case, we were buying regular crystal styrene. He said, let's try impact styrene. And impact styrene has a small amount of rubber particles put into it for the express purpose of making it non-brittle. And if you take impact styrene that contains a little bit of rubber to make it tough, the same rubber helps make the combination tough. Now, if you put more rubber into the combination, you get a tougher product. But he literally started a project to blend it. And one other thing that might get left out of here, I think Finholt commissioned Ralph Hagen and company at the research laboratory, at Louisville Major Appliance Laboratory, to study blends of PPO. And they made ABS blends and ASA blends and SAN blends and almost any kind of polymers around, they blended. Did a lot of work on blending, and they helped perfect this Noryl as we know it.
But that was after Cizik had put
it. But Cizik was the first one who happened to put in rubber-modified polystyrene and made essentially rubber-modified Noryl, which was the thing that we really end up selling.
And he was working for this PPO?
He was working for the PPO project, and he was in a marketing function at the time reporting to Finholt.
So it was in Finholt's...
He was a wild, crazy... Kraut, if you will, or Austrian, whatever it was. When he came up to Pittsfield, he came from Monsanto, but he came by way of Bridgeport was where our headquarters was at the time. We talked with in Bridgeport, and the operation was there. But I was told to keep an eye on him and help him. First thing he did, he needed some Variax for some reason, and he went and took all the Variax off somebody's setup that they had on an aging program. put on. took over the extruder when somebody else had it scheduled and had cleaned it up to use. All I was doing was fighting his battles to keep him out of trouble with the people who were residents. But
he made this big cut.
He made a very key critical discovery.
I wanted to get sort of a feeling, what was the state of the project between the time you introduced the new product and this modified thing? Was there a kind of a crisis situation in that you had a product and it really didn't have any markets?
No, I think everybody was going on in the faith that we could solve all the problems.
That seems to have been a philosophy that pervades.
We could solve
all of these things. Of course, that's gutsy to make that kind of investment. But then you'd had a history of success with the polycarbonate putting up plants.
We thought that we would solve the problem.
Yeah. Does that go all the way back to silicones? That kind of a view?
I don't know too much about the silicone background, GE really did, from everything I know, a great pioneering job on taking a little bit of technology and building into a super technological position in the silicone. Our boo-boo there was that we were much stronger technologists than we were marketeers. And we neglected the markets and polished the technology, and Dow Corning went after the markets first, technology second.
Yeah.
And eventually the marketing first, technology second scheme prevailed. And I think that this is one of the things that we learned pretty quick here that the marketing is very, very critical. Technology can and will come along, but without the markets, nothing will happen.
Yeah.
And there is very good reason for us to pride ourselves and talk about we are technology based but marketing driven. This holds up quite a bit.
I wanted to change the direction of the discussion.
I just got one last point to make sure, just to get this clear for the record. Jack Welch was really not involved in this product definition. He was involved in the chemical engineering of the product part. He was not involved.
But as you see on some of the write-ups there, Jack Welch was never involved in one phase of anything. He was always involved in all phases.
And he was here when the key developments, for example, going from crystalline polystyrene to HIPS.
Yes. Actually, Jack at one time had been operating an injection molding machine, I like to say, which was tiller operated, which was a wheel with pulleys to do injection molding. Jack had owned a crystal styrene business, crystal styrene PPO. Jack was well aware of it, but I would give credit to Finholt, his wild marketing guy, for pushing applications. And he hired Finholt, and he later hired another guy for the express purpose of what can we put into this thing to modify, change it, etc.
No, it was Gundorf hired.
No, Finholt was the guy who was the marketing.
No, I mean he
ultimately, Finholt reported to to Gutov at this point.
Then, so Welsh then became the manager afterwards based on his overall...
Welsh, as I say, was interested and knowledgeable in the chemistry. He was very much in the engineering, and he stuck his nose very early into the marketing and was very much involved in marketing. And I would say that he made major contributions in all phases. There's no taking that away from him. The other little vignette that, again, I don't know for the record whether he likes or not, but one of my favorite stories is that he did resign from GE. Welsh, when he found out that a classmate got a higher salary increase at the research laboratory that he got here, and Lutov wouldn't let us match his peer salary, he resigned. We had a little farewell party, and then he came back.
Why did he come back?
Because Gutov literally spent a night selling him on coming back.
Why did you let him go in the first place?
Well, the reason he went in the first place was Welsh was working for a boss who was a little bit weaker, no question, quite a bit weaker than Welsh.
Mm.
And Welsh didn't stand to have a buddy weaker than him around.
Yeah.
And didn't like it at all. And then he found out that a guy named Gertner at the research laboratory who graduated in Illinois with him got $200 more on his annual appraisal than Welsh got. And Welsh told his boss, who was Copeland, a weaker one, that Gertner and I were classmates at school. He's bright, but I'm a hell of a lot smarter than he ever was. And if he's worth $200 or $500 more to the research laboratory than I am, I quit. And his boss took the story to Gutov and says, explained to him, I was there and explained to him, Welsh says that we don't at least match what Gertner gave him a salary, he quits. He says, all right, if I match it. And Gutov said, hell no, let him quit. Nobody's going to tell us how to run our business. So the time came about two or three weeks later or so, we were having a staff meeting here, and Gutov was up from Bridgeport, and myself and Penhold and Colton, whoever was sitting, our finance guy, etc. We're sitting there having a meeting, and Copeland asked to be excused. He was called out, and he wanted to say goodbye to Welsh, who that was his last day. And he came back in and said he just said goodbye to Welsh. And would Reuben care to say goodbye to him, since it's his last day, having a party that night? Or had the party like the night before, I guess. But Reuben said, yeah, I'll talk with him. He said, I'll be right back. And he left, that was about 4 o'clock, and he didn't come back. And we sat till 5:30, he didn't come back. And what the hell was it? We broke up our meeting. And he had taken Jack down to one of our local joints here, and they sat till pretty late at night and talked. Jack sheepishly came back after the thing and said he decided not to go.
So he never really left.
He never left.
He never left.
But right. He had resigned and he had run out his notice. And but he came back on, and I would say within 2 months, I don't know, maybe a little longer, maybe a little less shorter, he was running the organization of his former boss.
That must have been quite an evening session they had together. You wonder what was said at that session.
I think that there must have been some commitments to that.
About the future.
Well, yeah. He stayed, and he stayed on, and made out pretty well ever since. But he didn't stay anybody's reportee or underling very long. He made a pretty good path up here, and from the very beginning, it was quite obvious that he was kind of held on more on the ball than there's Reuben. And Reuben was a smoother talker, but Jack dealt some facts. Charlie Reed picked him up as sort of a champion.
Let me get one more detailed question. So you sent me that nice Harvard Business School case study that Jack Welch wrote up, which ended with the four options being presented for PPO. Either you go full speed with it as a business, there were two intermediate ones, and then one drop it all together. Am I correct in assuming that it was the top option, the full speed ahead one, that was adopted?
Okay.
I just wanted to, because I sort of left off the ending.
That was an interesting story, but Jack wrote the story.
Yeah. Not that you feel that was a pretty accurate story.
I think that's a very good story.
And we can't use that as a source. For the reason.
Well, I have no objection to using it as a source.
I mean,
it's not the letter Jack objects.
I mean, you don't find anything, because sometimes they fictionalize those things.
What should we say, fiction thing. Very good story.
Of course.